A beautiful piece of physics research out of Brown University is making the rounds today. New research shows that Einstein's theory of relativity, specifically relativistic effects on electrons moving at significant fractions of the speed of light in heavy elements, directly shapes the nature of chemical bonds in those elements. This research has 268 points and 100 comments on HN.
This sounds exotic, but it actually resolves something that has puzzled chemists for a long time. Gold, for example, has a distinctive yellow color. Most metals are silver gray. Mercury is liquid at room temperature, while its neighbors on the periodic table are solid. These anomalies can't be explained by standard chemistry. The explanation is that in heavy elements, the inner electrons are moving fast enough that relativistic effects, specifically the relativistic increase in electron mass, cause the electron orbitals to contract. That contraction changes how the outer electrons interact, which changes the bond energies, which changes everything from color to melting point.
What's wonderful about this research is that it validates a theoretical prediction with experimental evidence. Relativistic effects on chemistry had been theorized and calculated, but direct experimental confirmation of the mechanism is a different thing. The HN thread has some commenters who are pointing out that this is a beautiful case of physics bleeding into chemistry, a reminder that the boundaries between scientific disciplines are somewhat arbitrary, and the underlying reality doesn't respect them.
There's also the lost city discovered beneath Egypt's desert, which has 134 comments and is generating the kind of excited discussion you'd expect. An ancient city with a church and other structures buried under the sand, archaeologists using ground-penetrating radar and other non-invasive survey techniques have been able to map structures without excavation. The site appears to date to the Byzantine period, which spans roughly the 4th through 7th centuries CE.
The HN comments have gone deep into archaeology methodology, which is the kind of tangent that makes the community so interesting. Several commenters are discussing how satellite imagery, LIDAR, and ground-penetrating radar have transformed our ability to find archaeological sites. We're almost certainly going to discover more lost cities in the next 20 years than in the previous century, simply because the detection tools have improved so dramatically.
Connecting to historical themes, the Late Bronze Age Collapse piece, a long-form essay from the A Collection of Unmitigated Pedantry blog, which is a phenomenal history resource, has 377 points and 261 comments. The Late Bronze Age Collapse, which happened around 1200 BCE, is one of history's most dramatic cases of systemic civilizational failure. In roughly a generation, the major palace-based civilizations of the Eastern Mediterranean, Mycenaean Greece, Hittite Anatolia, the Egyptian New Kingdom, contracted dramatically or collapsed entirely, and the Bronze Age trading network that had connected them dissolved.
What makes this relevant to a tech community in 2026 is obvious. It's one of the best historical case studies in how complex interdependent systems can fail. The Bronze Age trading network depended on specialized regions: Cyprus for copper, Canaan for tin routes, Egypt for grain, and when multiple stressors hit simultaneously, the network's interdependence became a liability rather than an asset. There's a reason this piece is trending on HN, alongside stories about supply chain failures and the U.S. medical glove manufacturing crisis.
Which brings us to that story. Almost $1 billion later, the United States still cannot reliably manufacture medical gloves domestically. The Bloomberg piece traces the history of repeated government attempts to build domestic medical glove production capacity, the fundamental economic challenges of competing with Malaysian manufacturers who have decades of specialized expertise and scale, and the policy failures that have allowed this vulnerability to persist even after COVID made the stakes crystal clear.
This is a story about industrial policy, comparative advantage, and the limits of what government spending alone can accomplish. Manufacturing expertise is not something you can simply purchase with an appropriation. It requires years of accumulated process knowledge, trained workers, supplier relationships, and organizational learning. The fact that nearly $1 billion in subsidies hasn't solved the problem suggests that the solution requires a different approach than financial support alone.
New York City's ban on deceptive subscription practices is getting 537 points, strong engagement. The legislation targets the classic dark pattern of subscription services, making it easy to subscribe and extremely difficult to cancel, hiding cancellation options, automatically renewing subscriptions at higher rates, and using design tricks to prevent users from understanding what they're signing up for.
What's interesting is that this is a city-level regulation rather than federal. New York has a history of using its regulatory weight to set de facto national standards. When New York requires something, companies often comply nationally rather than maintain separate product versions. The HN community is largely supportive of the policy substance, but has an interesting discussion going about enforcement. How do you prove that a cancellation flow was deliberately designed to confuse users rather than just being poorly designed?
Which gets into questions of intent, design documentation, A or B testing records, all of which become relevant in enforcement investigations. There's also a Good Samaritan issue. Some of the most egregious practitioners will simply leave the New York market rather than comply, while compliant companies absorb the regulatory cost. Whether that's a feature or a bug depends on your regulatory philosophy.
Now, Marcus, you mentioned earlier that we should pick our most confident technical claim today and interrogate it. The candidate I'd nominate is our discussion of Starlink, specifically the assertion embedded in the SpaceX filings and largely accepted in the HN discussion that operating at low enough orbital altitudes guarantees natural deorbit within a few years, which makes the 100,000 satellite constellation environmentally benign from a debris standpoint.
That's a good candidate. Let me steelman the position first. SpaceX's satellites orbit at altitudes where atmospheric drag is significant, and their current operational satellites are designed to deorbit within 5 years, even without propulsion. At that scale of natural attrition, the argument goes, you avoid the long-term accumulation that creates Kessler-type risks. The physics are real.
But here's what would have to be true for that confidence to be misplaced. The analysis assumes that the satellites function as designed, that they successfully deorbit rather than becoming debris at their operational altitude. Current Starlink satellites have a failure rate that, at a constellation of several thousand, has already left dozens of defunct satellites in orbit. Scaled to 100,000, and even a small percentage failure rate could mean thousands of defunct satellites at operational altitude. The second assumption is that orbital slot interactions at that density remain manageable, that the maneuvers required to avoid collisions between satellites, between your own satellites, and between your satellites and others don't create new failure modes.
There's also the question of what happens during solar maximum, when increased atmospheric heating actually expands the upper atmosphere and changes drag profiles significantly. Some analyses suggest that satellites designed to deorbit in 5 years under typical conditions might behave differently during periods of extreme solar activity.
So if we're wrong about the safety of this scale-up, what should we watch for? Three things. An increase in the rate of debris-related maneuvers required by other satellite operators, any change in SpaceX's reported satellite failure rates as they scale, and regulatory decisions by the FCC or ITU about imposing independent verification requirements on the deorbit performance claims. If SpaceX is granted approval without those independent verification requirements, that's a signal that the regulatory system is accepting the claim on faith rather than evidence.
That's a concrete set of indicators. We'll keep an eye on it.